Hello and welcome to Alliance Manchester Business School's Original Thinking podcast. Today's podcast was recorded at our latest Original Thinking lecture. This event series showcases the latest research and original thinking from academic colleagues at Alliance MBS. In this episode, we hear from Professor of Accounting at AMBS, Javed Siddiqui, who discusses the potential policy implications of accounting research in developing countries.
Right. Thank you so much, Fiona, for this kind introduction and also for inviting me to deliver this original thinking lecture. Very nice to see so many of my colleagues turning up. I hope you understand that we're going to talk about accounting for the next hour. So if you want to leave, leave now. Wonderful to see Professor Stuart Tully, my PhD supervisor, of course, my colleague later on, turning up today. I've received lots of advice and just listened to most of Stuart's advice as a supervisor and also as a colleague. As part of his PhD supervision project, Stuart always advised me to support Manchester City, something that I hadn't taken. And I went to the other side of the city, and perhaps that wasn't a well thought decision to make. Also very happy to see Professor Chris Humphrey. Chris moderating this, for kindly agreeing to moderate the session. Chris, of course, has had a profound influence on my career in terms of his research and so on, something he might not be proudly admitting, but that's life, Chris. For today's session, I will talk briefly about accounting policymaking, especially in the context of developing countries where most of my research takes place. Hopefully we can all see the slides and all that. So basically, as Fiona said, my research primarily focuses around accounting, auditing, and governance issues. Mostly in the case, mostly in the context of developing countries, I kind of find the role of international development agencies and the role of the state quite fascinating in the developing economic context, because the context is so different from what we see here. Also, I've been recently involved in studying accounting and auditing reforms in the context of the UK, and the context, although the context is different, the issue kind of remains the same. Many of my colleagues or my students are quite surprised to know that I don't normally use numbers in my lectures or in my research. Rather, I talk about human rights, biodiversity, and cricket, which is normally not associated with accounting research. So I kind of go from my passion first and then try to link it with accounting. So today's discussion primarily will focus on regulatory development, the process of regulatory development in the context of our emerging economies. As I say, because I find the context quite fascinating. So this is where the accounting starts, of course. So we have got these four major actors in developing countries. So normally we have got this national level regulators that produce accounting, auditing, and governance standards. And then you've got the profession, you've got the state. In the developing world, there's also a very strong presence of international development agencies. So World Bank and IMF kind of has a very powerful, very strong presence. And if you look into the relationship between the regulators and the state, now normally in a Western context, I'll be carefully using the term Western here, in this context, maybe we are talking about an independent regulator. The regulations in developing countries also promote independence of the regulator. But in essence, what happens is that maybe they're financially independent, but they're still having to approach the state for various reasons, including their appointment, or for example, the renewal of their contract depends on the state. Although they are financially independent, the state still has the control over the budget. So they might be earning, but they can't spend without the state's permission. So they are very much dependent on the state. The state in many of these developing countries are then also quite dependent on international development agencies. So World Bank, as I say, having very strong presence, Now, of course, one reason is obvious. It is because of financial dependence. So you need foreign currency, and World Bank or the IMF provides that foreign currency. That's understood. But also the other factor that sometimes we kind of ignore is the legitimacy issues of these governments in many, many developing countries. So in many developing countries, we are talking about the presence of military regimes or autocratic regimes. So in those contexts, the regime does not necessarily draw its legitimacy from its electorate. Rather, it kind of depends on the support of international support or credibility. So listening to World Bank or listening to IMF or listening to important foreign countries sometimes lends credibility to the government. So that's why you can see a direct kind of relationship between the state and these IDAs. These agencies, of course, have their own agenda and are, of course, are driven by their own agenda. So sometimes it's about extending credit, but also sometimes it's also about, for example, they'd like to ensure that the money they're lending to a particular country is being properly used. So they'd like to ensure transparency, accountability, and so on. So this is where these accounting, international accounting regulators actually come in. So there, there are evidences of lots of partnerships between agencies like World Bank with international financial regulators like International Federation of Accountants, IFAC. They work together to promote international standards. So World Bank, for example, lends money to a particular country, but they make it conditional that if you don't adopt a particular international accounting standard issued by IFAC, you're not going to get the money. So automatically that country adopts that particular accounting standard. Now, IFAC, what do they get out of it? Normally, they would be able to promote themselves as a world leader, as a regulator that's respected around the world because everybody has adopted their standards. So as you can see, they would promote harmonization. And in many cases, World Bank, through their ROSC, there is a project called ROSC that World Bank conducts in many countries. That project funds, and one of the kind of conditions for that particular project is adoption in case of accounting and auditing standards for government loan. So these regulators, of course, promote harmonization. Now, if you think about the national level regulators, perhaps the most important actor amongst this entire scenario, now they are kind of in a tight spot because, as I said, they would depend on the state for the purpose of economic dependence and also for the purpose of appointments and so on. So they'd have to listen to state, which is, in a sense, listening to World Bank, and then, of course, international standards are being promoted. At the same time, these regulators, I mean, my experience with regulators in developing countries is that they are actually quite smart. We think sometimes there's a perception there's a lack of capacity, but I don't see a lack of capacity. I think they are very smart in terms of understanding the issues. So they understand that they're actually working in a particular context where, for example, the corporate sector is dominated by very influential families who have, you know, all the power, including political power. So they can't really go against or try to control these very influential families that dominate the corporate world. The market is not efficient enough to be able to differentiate between good accounting, so a good audit and a bad audit. So you rarely see that, you know, Big Four auditing, I'm not saying Big Four is a better auditor, but Big Four auditing may not actually promote or result in, you know, higher share prices or any stock market reaction. So basically, rarely you'll see that a change in to better quality auditor leads to better quality, kind of reaction from the capital market. So the capital market does not simply differentiate between good accounting and bad accounting or good governance and bad governance. The stock prices simply doesn't really reflect that. There's a weak legal structure, of course. Implementation is quite poor. All the laws are there, but implementation seems to be quite poor. Now, because there's a dominance of these highly powerful individuals in the corporate world, who are very, very, very well connected politically, There's this tendency for them to kind of bypass any kind of accounting, auditing, or governance regulations because they derive the legitimacy from the political leaders. They have these connections. They know that although they are not meeting the requirements in terms of auditing or governance, they can still survive. As a result, auditing now becomes an unnecessary deterrent in a sense. So it's a mandatory thing that they'll have to do, but there's no point having a better quality audit done because at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter to the stock market. So why would they pay higher for the sake of that? So that leads to, of course, a race to the bottom in terms of fees being paid to auditors. Of course, there's an impact on quality and so on. So as you can see, all these so national level regulators are working in a context with all these constraints. And then they are being prescribed with these international financial reporting standard or standards of auditing, which the state is actively pursuing, and they'll have to accept that. So in a sense, they reluctantly accept that because they understand that it's not going to work for their country, but that's what the government wants. So they would want to accept that. So that kind of leads to a kind of ritualistic, not a serious adoption of international standards. And if you notice, the national accountancy body is the profession, which is supposed to be, you know, a major actor in this entire architecture, seems to be clueless. So there is no connections to any of them. So this profession, of course, they also understand the context very, very well. They understand that in this particular context is something is almost impossible to deliver good quality audit because again, the fees are not sustainable. They understand that they'll have to listen to the government. Otherwise, the government knows their weaknesses, so they will be in trouble. So again, I almost observed no lobbying against adoption of international standards. So this is how, in a sense, international standards get adopted in many developing countries, not because of the efficiency. I mean, the common narrative is that adoption of IFRS leads to a reduction of cost of capital and so on. But if you think about the political economic process, this is the process it seems that they actually get through in the context of developing countries. So just to give you an example of Bangladesh, where most of my research comes from, I've been observing this market, this audit sector for a very long time. I've seen that they're a very prompt adopter of any kind of new international regulation. So anything that comes in, the profession seems to be agreeing or accepting, the regulators seem to be adopting it very, very quickly. But if you think about it, so for example, just after the Enron follow-ups, the UK did not prohibit non-oil services. They actually adopted as a threats and safeguards approach. But in the US, the Sarbanes-Oxley actually prohibited many of the alternative services to be provided by auditors. World Bank, of course, very much influenced by the US policies, kind of prescribed that for the purpose of Bangladesh. They adopted that. Now, in the case of Bangladesh, I mean, companies are normally of a limited size. There's lack of skills. And in that particular context, if you try to adopt or impose the Western definitions of independence and audit, that might be counterproductive because if you think of a small listed company, they don't seem to be able to afford a chartered accountant, a very qualified accountant. They have been depending on the audit firm to provide them with some kind of consulting service. And now, because of this new adoption, certainly they can't do that anymore. So in a sense, if you speak to many of these head of accounts, they will say that our quality has suffered because now we can't recruit those auditors. So this adoption of this sudden adoption of these standards seem to be affecting the quality of accounting in developing countries. Similar to non-oil services, Bangladesh also adopted the requirement for a 3-year mandatory rotation of audit firms. In the UK, very recently, the FRC has proposed a 7-year rotation that hasn't gone through, but a country like Bangladesh has adopted that. I understand with an informal kind of arrangement that the incumbent auditor actually remains in place. On paper, after 3 years, a new auditor comes in, they sign papers, but in practice, it's the same auditor continuing for a longer time. So the market has kind of learned to live with it in a sense. Similar approach in kinds of in terms of adoption of corporate governance practices. So, I mean, if you look into the Bangladesh corporate governance code, very similar to the combined code of corporate governance that we have in the UK, although the conditions are completely different. So, similar notions of independent directors. I'm not saying directors are independent in the UK, but of course, in the case of Bangladesh, there's of course a limited pool of skilled independent directors. Audit committees have sat in many of these audit committees as an observer. Normally, audit committee is supposed to be independent, but there seems to be, so the audit committee sits, but then there's this presence of an executive director in the board who sits in the committee, but that doesn't get minuted. So there's an invisible presence of an executive member in the board. So I don't know how that audit committee is going to operate. CEO chair separation, again, prescribed by the combined code. They have separated, but it's the father as the chair and the son as the CEO, something like that. So as you can see, board diversity, again, last year, the GRI actually came up with a report on Bangladesh, how board diversity has improved over the last 5 years significantly. Now, just going to the numbers and just taking a step back, we kind of found out that most of these female directors that now sit in the board are actually members of the same family. So on paper, in terms of numbers, diversity has improved, but in essence, nothing has changed. So as you can see, I mean, there is this adoption, but what has happened as a result, we don't really know. Independent public oversight, one of my, Fatima, my PhD student, is working on independent public oversight, development of that in the context of Bangladesh. And so far from our work, what we understand, that since the inception of the Financial Reporting Council in 2017, the only thing they seem to have done is to find a rented house for themselves. They don't seem to have had a major influence in terms of policymaking because they seem to be worried, afraid of going after these big shots in the corporate sector. CSR and sustainability, again, Bangladesh ticks the box very promptly. In the banking sector, there's a requirement to invest a particular amount of money out of your profits on CSR. Sustainability is something India has also done. But if you look into that, our research basically shows that a large amount of that fund actually goes to politicians. So in a sense, you're spending CSR in the name of CSR, actually engaging with political activities or in a sense, paying bribe to politicians, which is surprising. And so because of this adoption, Bangladesh manages to tick most of the boxes of international standards adoption. So the IFAC, the global regulatory body for accounting standards, issues the statements of membership obligations. So they have got 7 statements that each single country is supposed to meet, and Bangladesh ticks all the boxes. That results of that allows IFAC to kind of state or establish a narrative that they're a global voice because look, more than 85 countries around the world tick all our boxes. So we must be very popular. We're a very competent global body. So as I say, international global bodies also have their own agenda to kind of put forward these essence of harmonization. Also, I mean, if you look into the Bangladesh case, in 2008, the Institute of Chartered Accountants of England and Wales actually entered into a memorandum of understanding with the Bangladesh Audit Institution. This was again a project funded by the World Bank, a twinning arrangement. And in their website, ICAW proudly kind of has a report on raising professional standards worldwide and how they're supporting growth and development in Bangladesh. So from that report, you'll find they claim to be a very well-organized professional body, ICAW, and how they are kind of contributing to the development of Bangladesh. If you ask people in Bangladesh, I don't think auditors are part of the development process. They're absent from any narrative around development. And again, this kind of projects or kind of extension of or partnerships allow global bodies, we saw the case of IFAC, ICAW, this narrative that they are a global leader of the profession. Many people around the world are listening to them. What it does, on the other hand, for the Bangladeshi profession, it lends them credibility. So they, I mean, if you go to their website, they proudly advertise that they are partnerships with ICAW, reciprocal arrangements of membership. So I understand their interest very clearly, of course, but from ICAW's point of view, there should be more care exercised when you're entering in these kinds of partnerships. So basically, so far, what I've told you, I think everybody knew that anyway. So basically, if you talk about case of financial audit to corporate governance reforms, it seems that, of course, it doesn't work in developing countries because the context is very different. And of course, although it doesn't work, it does allow, the harmonization process does allow the establishment of this narrative that, you know, you're a global body and so on. So in a sense, if you think about, okay, financial audit traditionally does not work in countries that are in the developing world. So what, or does anything in terms of audit work? So just going back to another case of social audit, in this case in Bangladesh. So we have looked into, Bangladesh happens to be the second largest exporters of ready-made garments. So this is, of course, a major earner of foreign currency for the government, very important sector, more than 80% of the revenues of the government comes from it. In 2013, there was a major collapse, a major building collapse called Rana Plaza. I'm sure many people are aware of that. It's the second largest industrial accident in history. More than 1,100 people, workers, lost their lives in factories that were producing T-shirts and clothes for example, for Disney, for Primark, and so on. Now, this is not the first time. Of course, the scale was different, but this is not the first time that accidents happened. The industry was prone to fire safety, building safety. There has been multiple accidents before Rana Plaza. But the problem is the owners of these factories are also members of the parliament. So the presence of the state business nexus, again, was a problem in terms of implementation, for example, of the labor law or working conditions of minimum wages. This Rana Plaza, of course, was in a sense an eye-opener. Now, as I say, Bangladesh is the second largest producers of RMG, exporters of RMG around the world, because it is also the cheapest outsourcing location around the world. So the wages paid or in terms of cost of production, it is much cheaper to produce in Bangladesh than in other countries. So these brands, these large brands, of course, they kind of got worried after the Rana Plaza collapse, because if this cheap outsourcing location goes away, their cost of production and their profits margin is going to reduce significantly. So this Rana Plaza actually triggered a lot of actions from the brands, the international brands. There were two initiatives taken by European brands and US Northern American brands taken together called Alliance and Accord. Essentially, we are talking about certification of building and fire safety. So what they did that after 2013, this is a private sector initiative, not a government law. What they did, they had initiated this or established this regime where inspectors would go to every single factory and kind of certify for building and fire safety. If a particular factory does not meet the requirements, they cannot export to a particular brand. And we have, of course, spoken to a large number of respondents in the factories, to workers and so on. Previously, the same arrangement was in place. The government inspectors were supposed to visit and ensure that everything's compliant with the labor law. At that time, people were saying life was much more easier because you could just pay off the government inspectors and that's it. But now, because Alliance and Accord are here, they are supported by the brand, the same inspectors maybe have got a job in the private sector. Now they're coming back. They're much more serious. in terms of trying to implement changes, because otherwise, of course, their jobs won't stay. And as a result, just in 7 years, more than 93% of these factories were certified to be safe in terms of building and fire. Of course, there are other issues that we have documented in many papers and about the scope or about the narrow nature of the inspection. So they might be looking into building and fire safety, but not necessarily what the workers are getting in terms of payment. So maybe there's a scope for extending the opportunity for us extending the scope of that kind of audit. But what it does kind of indicate is that if you're very serious, that does seem to work. So if you think about the political economy of social audit in this case, so you've got this industry regulator for the R&D sector. The state, they don't depend on the state. Rather, the state depends on them because they are the major earners of foreign currency for the state. The manufacturing factories also have a very good relationship with regulators because they kind of negotiate with the foreign brands on behalf of them. The foreign brands, the state, of course, needs the foreign brands because after 2013, there was a narrative about foreign brands trying to withdraw from Bangladesh, and there was a lot of lobbying going on so that they don't withdraw from Bangladesh. So that resulted in that very immediate establishment of the regime. The international brands, of course, they knew the problems in Bangladesh. It's impossible to say that whether they had taken actions or not. They would claim that they had actions before, but their claim was that the government wasn't listening before Rana Plaza, but Rana Plaza gave them an opportunity to be listened. So these international brands, of course, did not want to leave Bangladesh because, as I say, they are driven by their cost initiative. So their efforts to minimize costs, and Bangladesh happens to be one of the, in terms of cost, you can make a large margin out of Bangladesh. So they won't leave Bangladesh, but in order to stay in Bangladesh, they have to install this audit regime, at least to give an impression that everything was fine in Bangladesh. And that seemed to work very quickly. These regulations, these standards of audit or of safety inspections were drawn up very quickly by the industry themselves, by these factories themselves. So these are kind of homegrown standards. And as a result, because there are consultations going around and the impact of Rana Plaza, we could see a very serious and very effective, in a sense, implementation very quickly that changed the scenario very quickly. So it does seem that the model for social audit in this particular case seems to be different from the model from financial audit that nobody cares about. If you look into the financial audit of the companies that collapsed because of the Rana Plaza or accident, the auditor's report actually says nothing about it. The auditor's report certifies gives a true or fair view that the companies made profits. Doesn't talk about 1,100 workers losing lives because of that. So as you can see, the effectiveness of that kind of audit is, of course, highly questionable. So basically, sorry, I'm not still there for thanking you for your time. So basically what I'm trying to say is that traditional financial audit, in a sense, seems to be quite ineffective in many developing countries. I'm sure Bangladesh is just an example, but the situation, for example, in Nigeria, in Pakistan, in Indonesia, very large countries, very similar. Similar collapses, for example, in Pakistan in the football industry. So basically, the conditions are very, very similar. And as you can see, the case kind of demonstrates that international adoption doesn't really work for these countries. So basically, this one size fits all that's been promoted for the sake of harmonization. World Bank and other development agencies need to understand that different countries are, of course, different. And of course, they will need different types of standards. So promoting just for the sake of promotion, whether that makes any sense. If you're a regulator in a developing country, let's start with developed country first. So let's say if you're a regulator in the UK, and if you're making a decision on the basis, for example, our work on joint audits, the recent work on joint audits seems to show that the UK has been promoting the introduction of joint audits in this context, and there's absolutely no evidence that suggests that it's going to improve on equality, but the government seems to be accepting that, so that might go through. So there is lack of evidence-based decision-making also in the context of UK. The problem is, once UK does that, I'm pretty sure in 5 years, 10 years down the line, we'll see many developing countries adopting, because they will say that it has worked. You know, UK has adopted it. If you speak to regulators in Bangladesh or in many countries, they will refer to UK as if nothing can go wrong in UK. So basically, there is that mindset that the practices in UK or Europe or, you know, Western countries are the best, and we need to adopt that. So basically, regulators in both countries need to understand that they need to be more responsible. So in the UK or in many other countries in the West, of course, if you're taking a decision, there are consequences beyond the boundary. I think that's what you need to recognize. Also, if you're a regulator in developing countries, I think you've got to understand that anything that comes from the West does not necessarily mean it's the best thing to do. Just the last slide in terms of auditing. So basically, we are saying that financial audit does not seem to work. At the same time, social audit, I mean, the audit that we kind of studied is not really social audit. It is an inspection. But of course, the social audit would incorporate many other issues, but it is quite similar to a social audit. But that does seem to be more impactful in terms of changing lives. So I've spoken to many workers, and they said, okay, maybe things have not changed radically in terms of wages, but I feel much more safer compared to before. So I think there is this influence or impact of audit that's very, very, very clear. So basically, maybe we can, in countries, in many developing countries, maybe we can think about whether the boundary that we are kind of imposing on financial audit at the moment, which is deemed to be quite irrelevant, maybe we can extend that, or maybe the boundaries of any kind of audit needs to be extended to kind of suit it for a particular industry, particular country, and so on. So as you can see, the Rana Plaza collapse kind of demonstrates that those standards were actually designed for a particular industry, very specific standards, and that seemed to work because people understand what that industry needed. We seem to be imposing, in case of financial audit, again, a one-size-fits-all kind of audit, that everybody needs the same information about the audit, and that doesn't seem to be working. And that kind of narrative is not very different from what we have got in the UK. So for example, in the UK, the Brydon report that came out 3 years back now, actually talks about changing the boundaries of audit. It recognizes the fact that just like in any other country, auditing is losing in terms of, is losing its relevance. So we need to make auditing more interesting, more effective, more relevant, and in order to do that, we need a more holistic kind of audit. So changing the focus, changing the boundaries of auditing seems to be quite important. And this whole narrative of, I mean, this recent whole narrative of accountants can change the world. I mean, looking at accountants, of course, if you're a typical accountant, I don't see you changing the world. But it is about, when we're talking about accountants saving the world, we are actually not talking about financial accounting saving the world. We are talking about sustainability accounting. We are talking about this kind of inspection, and that can promote changes around the world. So basically, if you're talking about ESG, if you're talking about non-financial, we can see the potential of audit. But again, if you go back to this financial, this mundane sense of audit, it doesn't seem to be working. And one thing to perhaps, in terms of policy implication, perhaps the regulators in many developing countries maybe need to take a step back and think whether they'd like to blindly follow the World Bank, or they'd like to kind of take the leadership of their own destiny in a sense. So if you look around in many developing countries, especially in Asia, the impact, the influence of World Bank is gradually diminishing because of the economic development that's happening around. As a result, I mean, if I go back to Bangladesh 20 years back, the World Bank representative was like a governor. He was very powerful. Now he has to wait for 5 hours to meet a minister. I mean, that should have happened before. So that kind of shows the changing nature of the relationship between the World Bank and the state. And that kind of creates two possibilities. Number one, At the presence of World Bank, despite its many problems, at least we had some reforms going around. And that might be good or bad, you can criticize that, but maybe they could ensure transparency, accountability. Maybe because of the diminishing role of World Bank, that might completely go away. That might be that won't be good for the countries. At the same time, the diminishing role of World Bank also means that regulators can actually take a leadership now. They can actually say that, you know, because the World Bank is not influential anymore, I'm not going to adopt this particular standard because we think it's not proper. So there's this possibility that regulators can actually define their own boundaries, and that perhaps might result in further reforms, because what I've also inspected that despite its limitations, reforms are easier to achieve in developing countries. Many structural reasons for that. So it might be possible that we're contemplating introduction of non-financial reporting in the UK, maybe countries, the smaller countries, might be able to take a leadership in that and demonstrate by various cases how social audit, how ESG audit has actually worked in that particular context. So I will kind of finish my presentation on that particular note. Hopefully it wasn't too much of a pain. So thank you so much for your time. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much, Javed. I'm Chris Humphrey. I'm going to lead this final Q&A session. And just really mainly just to follow up, Javed, we've got some questions coming in already.
Did you make this up, Chris?
But just, you mentioned, obviously, in your first slide, political economy, you then talk about harmonization. How political is the promotion of harmonization? Generally, I mean, would you see it as more of a technical issue, or is it essentially political itself?
I think the straight answer is no. I won't see this as a technical issue. It is promoted as a technical issue. That's the narrative they tend to use. As I say, it's going to help in terms of reduction of cost of capital. In terms of how it is actually promoted, whose interests it serves, it seems to be serving the interests of powerful groups, serving the interests from a regulator's point of view. If you want to survive, you want to seem to be doing something. In many cases, regulators in developing countries, also in UK, are actually adopting standards or promoting standards, not because they think it's going to work, but simply because they think that will help them survive a little bit longer. So maybe that looks like a very much a political process in terms of how it is developed, although the narrative they seem to be using is a very rational process.
Well, in the sense of leading and following, because I mean, obviously part of this presentation was highlighting the capacity for innovation. But if you look to the harmonization movement, what is being led in a sense and what's being followed and who's leading and who's following? Is there scope to do different leadings and different followings?
Absolutely. I think, if you think about the way accounting standards have developed, it's always been led by the West. So US and in some cases, UK, some cases, Australia as well. So in a sense, if you speak to regulators in developing countries, this perception that anything perceived in the West is better than what we could even think about, I think that's where the hurdles come from. So I think we were speaking yesterday that many of these developing countries are not developing anymore. They've graduated to developed status. For example, South Korea, Qatar, and Malaysia. But they still seem to be adopting the same standards promoted by Western, so-called Western agencies. So I think it's also, in addition to resource dependence, it's also legitimacy and so on, it also, something about changing the mindset of the regulators in those countries. So, or maybe they are very smart. They don't want to take responsibility. They just want to adopt, because then they could just criticize that because we've made this adoption, this has happened. But if they're able to develop this, I think they won't. They don't want to take this responsibility of developing new standard, which might have an impact on the markets, maybe attract criticism as well.
If it will send you, I could just do a few of the questions online, because they follow on. I mean, some of the questions online, just to paraphrase them, are there examples where developing countries have actually set very innovative or high standards of corporate governance that other developing countries could learn from? Or is there a perspective that developing countries are trying to take? One example online is reference to China in terms of its promotion of its own national professional body. Would developing countries be keen and willing to learn from other developing countries rather than following the development?
So from that point of view, I can perhaps cite two examples. One is China that you mentioned, that during about 10 years back, 2010 onwards, they tried to develop their own super audit firms, and they've been trying to do that. That doesn't seem to have produced a lot of results so far, but we'll have to wait and see what happens. But at least they have taken the leadership in terms of trying to do something on their own. Also, if you look at India's case, I think India is the only country in the world that has mandated CSR spending for top 1,000 companies in the world. Again, there are criticisms of that, but at least I'll give them the credit that they have thought something outside the box, not being dominated or being instructed or being prescribed by somebody else. So there are, I think, recent examples of things maybe changing, but whether it's going to, one of the problems I would see in terms of that would be there might be changes for specific countries, but whether there's going to be worldwide dissemination of that practice, I'm not sure. Because if you think about the mechanism we've currently got, if World Bank is in charge of disseminating that, that might have an influence of what is getting disseminated and what is getting ignored. So the voices of many developing countries, maybe good practices, might not be heard because of these mechanisms.
Just related to that, Liz, could you just say a little bit more about what made social audit so impactful in Bangladesh?
So I think in terms of impact of social audit, social inspections in that particular case. So it was performed by the same Bangladeshi auditors, in a sense. Not auditors, but individuals. So it is not something that's performed by foreigners and so on. So there's more independent, nothing. So it was performed by people who are from the same country, working in the same context. But I think it is the seriousness of the brands.
But from the accounting profession?
Not necessarily. So sometimes from the accounting profession, but mostly from outside, third parties. But I think it's the seriousness of the brands. So they are kind of saying, if one more collapse happens, we're going to shut down our factories in Bangladesh. So I think that fear of losing revenues, I think that, or the visibility of the impact of audit, I think that actually played a role in terms of making social audit more effective. So if you look into, as I say, at the time of the Rana Plaza collapse, or following Rana Plaza collapse, none of the companies that were operating in the building actually mentioned in their audit reports that something happened like that. So as you can see, of course, financial audit doesn't capture any of that. But if you look into the social audit kind of perspective, they're kind of coming up and saying that, okay, if you do that, you have got health benefits, you've got safety benefits, and users, I've spoken to many workers, and they're saying that we feel, okay, there are still problems, but at least we feel safer than before. And that kind of tells me that there is an impact of audit somewhere.
So it's just on the process of innovation then, in a sense. I mean, for instance, if you took harmonization, you could actually be very good at harmonizing in terms of the Western concept of financial audit. But you apply it in a developing nation context and it remains, like you said, irrelevant to the developing agenda.
If you look at the narratives of development in many developing countries, I don't think auditors actually feature at all in that narrative. So, despite the claims made by CW and IFAC and so on, auditors do not seem to have a place in terms of development. Although, given the prevalence of corruption in many of these countries, auditors should have had a major place in major role in that kind of development, but the narrative is that, you know, financial audit, nobody cares, but social audit, okay, we can see the improvements. Maybe we can carry that out because that will bring more business for us.
So people care more if it's harmonized?
I don't think so. I don't think anybody would even notice if it's harmonized or not, because at the end of the day, doesn't have an impact on their lives.
Question from yours.
Yeah, well, the shifts the emphasis of the discussion a little bit. I had some questions about the role of the World Bank. So even if you seem to be suggesting that that role is declining now compared to what it was 20, 30 years ago, you sometimes hear it being said in the discussions around the World Bank, and the World Bank itself sometimes claims, I think, that it's not the same body at all as it was 20, 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. That it has learned from all the mistakes that they made during the heyday of the Washington Consensus, when the World Bank was run by people like Paul Volcker, for instance, where there was this very naive one-size-fits-all approach being rolled out with sometimes disastrous consequences. If you look at Indonesia, in the wake of the Asian financial crisis in the late 90s. And that's what the World Bank is doing now, is trying to be a little bit more sensitive to what works locally and try to take more sort of bottom-up approach, if you like, a top-down, one-size-fits-all approach. Your story seems to jar with that. I'm not sure if this is a story that pertains to other kinds of development projects that the World Bank gets involved in, because it doesn't seem to fit your story at all regarding economic normalization, where it's still well-sized.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really a bit skeptical about whether World Bank has changed, because if you look into many cases, they've got this ROSC program, for accounting and auditing, still continuing, still pitching IFRS adoption in every single country. If you look at the ROSC report for Vietnam and for Venezuela, it's almost the same. It's like copying and pasting the same stuff over and over again. So, yeah, I've also seen that narrative that, you know, things are changing in the World Bank and we are much more sensitive to local issues. But I don't see the evidence, at least in terms of accounting standard setting. I don't see the evidence of that. Maybe because of this declining influence of World Bank, maybe they're being more polite nowadays. I don't think in terms of the actual actions, things have changed drastically.
Another question from the audience?
Yes. Janet, you mentioned about private entities, not very large firms, becoming quasi-regulators, effectively, in Bangladesh. And it reminded me a little bit of the discussion about the oversized influence of ABI and NADF in the UK, so the Association of British Insurance and the National Association of Pension Funds, in the drafting of several UK corporate governance codes. So to what extent do you see similarities between a case in a developed country and another case in a developing country? And secondly, to what extent do we allow private entities to regulate and take more of this role relative to elected representatives in a country?
I think it's a nice one. Private governments, I think it's quite risky in many countries because you're talking about, yes, I mean, in Rana Plaza's case, it worked in a very specific context because there's a drive and, of course, there's an urgency for that. But if that becomes, a longer lasting problem, there will be the scope of lobbying and self-interest coming in, as you say, in Newcastle's case. So maybe private governance wouldn't be a solution for a very long time. It has to be state-led governance in some ways because we're still trying to be neutral and ensure that there's no bias. But I think inputs from the private sector in terms of people who know the industry, for example, in this case, the IMB industry, they knew what kind of standard might or might not work for them. If you look into auditing, there's almost all corporate governance adoption. There's almost no consultation taking place at all because it's the World Bank prescribing you're adopting. But in case of if, for example, there could be a corporate governance code developed in discussions with different industries, maybe it's not going to be a corporate governance code for the country, but maybe for a specific industry. Maybe that one might have worked better. I'm not very confident that private governance will work in a very long time, longer term, but maybe it's more, at least for immediate term, it's more, seems to be more impactful than what we have got in many countries.
Another question
from
the audience. If anybody else wants to make questions online, please do so. I've got a couple that we'll ask in a minute.
You made the case that the adoption of standards is just a kind of routine and uniform activity. But if we're in the, to put a kind of couple of counter arguments, we're in the case that a country is, we need standards, or someone is coming along, you need standards. Yes, we need standards. Here's some we prepared earlier. Use these. What harm can it do? So one argument is, well, use these because it's not good enough. And the second argument is, use these, there's no alternative. What's the alternative? So the question is, are there cases you can say where it, or how would you show that it causes actual harm to use, say, international standards? And what are the examples of alternatives that would have been better?
Yeah, very good question. I think it's easier to answer the first one, but the alternatives is going to be much more difficult, because if you think about it, for example, one specific case was about IFRS for SMEs. And in many countries in developing, many companies in the developing world would fall in the category of SMEs, but they seem to be earliest adopter of this IFRS about SMEs. India adopted this much earlier than for example, the US. And once they've done that, then they realize it doesn't really work for them. The cost of producing that statement is much higher. But the problem is they don't seem to be able to come up with an alternative, which then allows World Bank kind of to be able to come back and say that, look, you don't have an alternative, so this might still be better than not having anything else. So it is about developing the capacity of the regulators. As I said, I don't really feel that there's a training or capacity limitation there. I think it's also about the confidence that they can develop things and they can be allowed to develop standards. I think that's where the environment, I think, is the worry rather than the actual capacity.
Interesting. How could developing nations adopted the auditing expectations gap then?
Yes, of course. Chris has been talking about the expectation gap for the last 30 years, and we still have it. So yes, maybe.
Yeah.
But I think if you look into expectations gap in developing nations, the gap is also even wider because people expect all sorts of things from auditors, not understanding audit, but also, I mean, the way auditors perform in many cases is quite appalling. So I think that it's quite wide in that sense, whether it's going to narrow down, education might be a way of doing that.
Yeah, but that would be useful just to pick up on a question from the online messages. I mean, obviously, again, you started off with the emphasis on political economy. I mean, and talking about policy implications, I mean, you mentioned some of the policy implications of the adoption of standards, but where do you see the policy implications of accounting education sort of standing, and particularly what role do you see that accounting education could play in terms of facilitating development? And I guess just finally, I mean, in relation to that, I mean, do you envisage major changes taking place over the next decade or so in the developing nation context? I mean, how would you think things will look in 10 right. to 15 years time?
So four questions in that. So in terms of accounting education and its impact, accounting, I think the trouble that we seem to have with accounting education, we seem to be going towards harmonization or standardization even more in terms of how we teach accounting. I don't think we are in a place where we're teaching students to think more about different approaches to accounting or auditing, because maybe because of this professional bodies coming in, you know, many of our students are interested in attaining those professional qualifications, and that I would say does not really allow for innovation to take place in your mind. So maybe, of course, accounting education might have a role, can have a role, I'm sure it can have a role, but we have to design it properly to make people think about what can be done in certain contexts. Otherwise, for example, if you're in undergraduate level, you're still studying IFRS and US standards, when you work as a chartered accountant, you're going to implement that. That's normal because you've not been taught or trained to think differently. So I think education can have a role, but at the moment we don't see that happening. But maybe in Manchester we've got the scope of doing that because we've got these people who can really think differently.
I mean, a broader implication, just to close, Jav, in terms of some of the questions online, is how is the concept of public interest interpreted in terms of the developing nation context. And you mentioned it once on your slide, but it was from IFAC talking about it. But I mean, how would that, and how would that impact on your educational processes?
So public interest and the profession in many developing countries are totally different words. I don't think they would use it in the same sentence. So public interest is public interest, but accountants having a role in protecting public interest, it is hardly mentioned. So basically, if you look into many developing nations, yes, we talk about accounting, production of financial statement, and then we talk about public interest and something else. But the relationship between these two doesn't seem to be existing. So if you look, for example, after an accounting scandal or corporate collapse, auditors don't seem to have a place in the media. They're talking about directors doing this, they're talking about the government doing this, but there's no place for an auditor. So they're not saying, why did the auditor do this or did not do this? So in a sense, that they're completely missing from this entire discussion. And then coming up and then trying to claim that we are kind of protectors of public interest, that doesn't sound, that doesn't work very well. So yes, public interest perhaps is a narrative. Also in the case of UK, you can see ICW using public interest, but how well they've protected public interest, that's questionable as
well. Well, I think we'll leave it there, but I mean, thanks for raising a fascinating set of issues with lots of potential for future development, both in terms of education and research. So thanks very much, Gavin. I'll pass back to Bjorn.
Thank you. So can I just take a moment to say thank you to Javid for sharing his insights today. It's a really interesting discussion that has then ensured, which I'm sure will continue. Also like to thank Chris for facilitating the discussion. It is nice to have the opportunity where we have questions in the room and also have the opportunity to bring people from online. But let's offer Javid a very warm round of applause. Thank you, Javid.
Thank you for listening. We hope you found this episode insightful. For a list of our latest webinars, news, and useful business content, please visit ambs.ac.uk.